from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, on the heels of the Trump administration's release of its controversial approach to deporting undocumented immigrants, Department of Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly and Secretary of State Rex Tillerson have been meeting with officials in Mexico. Here's Tillerson.
In our meetings, we jointly acknowledged that in a relationship filled with vibrant colors, two strong sovereign countries from time to time will have differences.
Tensions between the two countries are at their highest in decades over U.S. immigration policy, a proposed border wall, and uncertainty around NAFTA. We look at U.S.-Mexico relations next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, you're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. President Trump's plans for a border wall and his insistence that Mexico pay for it prompted Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto to cancel a planned visit last month to Washington. This week, the Trump administration released an aggressive approach to dealing with immigrants who cross the border from Mexico. And today is the deadline set by President Trump for a full report on all the money and grants the U.S. provides Mexico. It's against this backdrop that Secretary of State Rex Tillerson and Department of Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly were in Mexico this week trying to move the relationship forward. In this hour forum, we look at the current state of U.S.-Mexico relations. But first, we're joined by Naha Katan. She's a correspondent for Bloomberg News in Mexico. Good morning, Naha Katan.
Hi, good morning, Mina.
Thanks for joining us. There was some talk that a meeting between Secretaries Tillerson and Kelly and President Peña Nieto would not happen, but it did, right, because the relations were so strained. But this meeting did happen. Do you know what they talked about?
Well, exactly. The meeting was, a source of conflict because no one was sure if it was going to happen. The economy minister said that unless they can reach some kind of agreement, it wouldn't necessarily happen. But in the end, it did. And we're light on details about what occurred. But, President Peña Nieto put out a statement saying that the focus of the meeting was on emphasizing dialogue and the importance of the U.S.-Mexico relationship. So not much detail there, but we got a lot more detail in the press conference between Secretary of State Tillerson, Videgaray, Kelly, and Interior Minister Osorio from Mexico.
Tell us, because we're getting a sense that President Trump's deportation plans really did dominate conversation.
They did. The Mexican officials sort of took the chance for this visit to talk tough against the U.S. immigration plan. And they said, it couldn't be a unilateral thing. You can't have deportation without cooperation from Mexico. And the U.S. can't just send any immigrant to Mexico, which was one of the Trump policies, that some immigrants would be sent to Mexico and then from there to Central America. They said, this will not stand.
And how is the meetings this week, how are they being viewed by the population of Mexico?
Yeah, so it's kind of a repeat of when Trump first visited Mexico last year, which is people are pretty angry here in Mexico. So you have columnists and TV personalities, of course, really dismissing what happened here. And I think their main issue, and you can see it plastered over all of the major newspapers, top of the fold, their major issue is that, Kelly said there won't be military used in deportations just hours, after Trump said that deportation is a military operation.
So how
that discrepancy was a big deal.
Yes, and how are people interpreting it?
One radio personality said, how do you talk to these people when they have such a difference of opinion between one, official and the other? It's actually something that Secretary Vida Garay, the foreign minister, said in private meetings with lawmakers, but which were leaked to the press, in which he said, you know, we don't see a unified message from the Trump administration, and it's difficult to talk to them because of it.
Well, Naha Katan, thanks so much for talking with us. I really appreciate it.
Sure.
Naha Katan is a correspondent for Bloomberg News in Mexico. Let me tell you who is joining us for the rest of the hour. We're joined by Alfredo Corchado. He's Mexico correspondent for the Dallas Morning News and author of the new book, Midnight in Mexico, A Reporter's Journey Through a Country's Descent into Darkness. Good morning, Alfredo Corchado.
Good morning, Nina.
And good morning to you, Duncan Wood, director of the Mexico Institute at the Wilson Center. Duncan Wood, are you there?
Yes, I am right here.
Thanks for joining us this morning as well. Alfredo Corchado, I want to start with you. It feels like the strategy here in terms of engaging with the U.S. is a combination of both tough talk, but also a willingness to talk. What do you make of this strategy?
It's the it's a good cop, bad cop strategy. It's in talking to Mexican officials, you know, they will say, we're not really sure who we're negotiating with. Is it Secretary of State Tillerson? Is it Homeland Security Kelly? Or is Donald Trump sort of in the shadow of everything we do? And the other thing that you hear a lot is that this is considered tweet diplomacy. And I think in some cases it's also tweet journalism, where you think this is what the story is. You think this is where the trend is. The same thing with diplomats. You know, they can come here. They can say the right thing. As Naha said, I think saying there won't be any mass deportations. There won't be. This will not be a military operation. That sort of goes well with the Mexican political elite. You know, they want to hear these kinds of things. I'm not sure that. That the person in San Francisco, that the immigrant in Fresno, California, or San Diego, L.A., will look at that and think they're safer. I mean, there are too many messages. Nothing is really coherent. Nothing is really something that you can believe in these days, or that you can really fact check, if you will.
Duncan, what I want to put the same question to you, just in terms of, does it appear to you that Mexico has a strategy? This sort of strong words, tough stance is actually, you know, a formal one? Or are they still finding their way with this new administration?
Yes and no. You know, I think that what we've seen the Mexican government has done since the election in November, which was, you know, a huge shock to the system. They entered into a moment of panic, and then they sort of withdrew, and they tried to formulate a strategy, much of which was dashed immediately after the inauguration. But what they have done, which I think is very, very impressive, is that they have begun a consultation process with the private sector and with leading analysts in Mexico about the future of the North American Free Trade Agreement from the Mexican point of view. They've begun to focus on diversification strategies on the economy, trying to looking at negotiating free trade agreements with many other countries around the world. They're looking to expand their economic relations with the rest of the region. They're building up an impressive network of friends and allies here in the United States, in particular in Washington. And I think that, you know, the fact that they are keeping the channels of dialogue open is a very important thing, because there is a great temptation to retreat into nationalism and just to say no, no, no. What they are doing, though, is that they're keeping the conversation going. They're focusing on important things like institutional mechanisms. To hear those words coming out of Rex Tillerson's mouth the other day was, you know, a godsend for most people who work on the bilateral relationship, because it means that many of the institutional mechanisms, such as the high-level economic dialogue, the educational agreement, which is called the FOBESI, the Mosaic, which focuses on innovation and entrepreneurship, and then, of course, the high-level security dialogue, that all of those things will continue, means that this is bigger than just one president and his tweets. Also, I think what we're seeing, and this is the heart of the Mexican strategy, is the question of issue linkage. What Vida Garay said the other day in the press conference, it's crucial that we understand what it means. He said, we want to talk about this relationship in its entirety, on its many different dimensions, which means that the Mexican strategy is, we're linking together economy, migration, and security. Mexico has not done that in the past because they felt that it's more productive to deal with these things separately. Now they are linked because Mexico has been pushed into a corner and finds that it's the only way that they can actually defend themselves in this diplomatic relationship.
Well, Alfredo Corchado, as Duncan Wood pointed out, there's a very strong nationalism that's going on in Mexico right now because they feel deeply insulted by the president. Even before he was elected, the rhetoric on the campaign trail sort of started all of this. So is Videgaray's message, you know, resonating with the population there?
Well, it's tough to say. I mean, there is certainly a strong sense of nationalism because of the deepening humiliation. But you have to remember that it was Luis Videgaray who many Mexicans blame for having started this so-called mess, and that he was behind the offering the invitation to Donald Trump back in, I think it was back in August, to come to Mexico. And that was there's a lot of controversy over that. The president's phone number, at least before he stood up to, or, you know, Shane stood up, sort of questionable, but stood up to President Trump last month. At the time, his phone numbers were at about 11-12%. So these are not the most popular people, but certainly there is a very, very deep sense of nationalism. And if anything, I think that's just been a really tough message to the United States. I mean, you're talking about a country that maybe 20 years ago, I mean, people were smuggling Milky Ways, chocolate from the United States. I mean, And since then, you've seen this remarkable integration between the societies, you know, both societies, to the point where, you know, at one point the United States was seen as the imperialist giant monster up to the north. It hasn't been that way. I mean, we are talking about a NAFTA generation that's grown up much more, feeling much more intertwined, much more part of the North America narrative. And that's, I think, has been sort of shadowed in the last few weeks.
Yes, you raise a good point. I mean, Duncan Wood, do you want to add anything to the context that all of this is happening in, you know, how U.S.-Mexico relations have been since NAFTA and the intertwining of the two countries?
Yeah, I mean, let me just make a quick point about the nationalism point, first of all, and that is that Peña Nieto has seen at least a temporary jump in his approval ratings since the cancellation of the visit to Washington. I expect that with Videgaray's strong words at the press conference, etc., that, you know, a lot of people will actually rally around the flag and rally around the president at this point in time. In fact, there was a piece published this morning by a professor from the Ibero-American University of Mexico City, which actually argues that this current crisis in bilateral relations may actually be the saving of the Peña Nieto administration. Mm. That may be wishful thinking on the part of some people within the administration. But, you know, certainly this is an opportunity for Peña Nieto to take a stand, and it may even be possible for him to actually have this marked down as his legacy, that he stood up for the interests of Mexico. And I think that's very, very important. And the reason why he's doing that is not because he's an opportunist. The reason why is because, as I said earlier on, they've been pushed into a corner, and other politicians in Mexico are quite happy to seize the mantle, to grab the flag and wrap themselves in it. And Peña Nieto knows that he has to do this at this point in time. Some people have even suggested it may change the electoral fortunes of his political party, the PRI, at the next election. I think it's too early to tell, and probably it's probably too late to save them at the next election. But anyway, we will see.
Yes.
In terms of the bilateral relationship.
Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. I think it's just, there's been a transformation of the bilateral relationship, no doubt. And we're looking at a relationship now which is worth almost $600 billion a year. Mexico, as an export market for the United States, is worth $240 billion a year. That is the second largest export market in the world for U.S. goods. Mexico is fully aware of how important it is as a market for U.S. exporters, and as an economy that supports almost 5 million jobs here in the United States. So they're not blind to that, and they're quite happy to roll out those figures time and time again and to make sure that their allies and friends here in the United States have access to that information. Mexico is also very, very conscious of the fact that the United States increasingly depends upon Mexico to stem the flows of Central American migrants through Mexican territory. And, of course, there is a a growing cooperation, not just of the in the fight against organized crime and drug trafficking, but also on anti-terrorism activities and also on intelligence sharing. This is something which, you know, 10 years ago was unthinkable. If you had asked me 10 years ago, would Mexican defense and security organizations, agencies, share intelligence with their counterparts in the United States, I would have said, absolutely not. You're dreaming in Technicolor. But it's happening today. And that's really what's at stake. And Mexico, of course, is quite happy to focus on that. Mexico matters to the United States in many, many ways. It's not just trade. It's about investment. It's about integrated production. It's about the integration of the two societies in a way which, you know, just wasn't there when the NAFTA was signed in 1994.
So you're talking about all the ways that Mexico has leverage in any negotiations with the United States. But if I could just, you know, drill down a little bit into those, are you saying then that, so for example, in terms of the Central American migrants that we were seeing on our border, that Mexico has been has played a big role in the reduction of those people at the border?
Yeah, beginning in 2013, Mexico began to enact something called the Plan Frontera Sur, or its Southern Border Strategy, which is building up its own capacity on its southern border with Guatemala and Belize, with some U.S. help, admittedly, and after a lot of pressure from the U.S. to do so. And the purpose of this plan, of this strategy, is to try to intercept people moving north who do not have the papers, also try to intercept the flows of illegal goods, and also try to disrupt the activities of organized crime. Now, just to give you an idea, in research that we've just published here at the Wilson Center, we can see that we've shown that in 2012, for example, 77,000 Central American immigrants were deported or returned by Mexican authorities. By 2015, that figure had gone up to 176,000. So that is 100,000 more Central Americans that are moving through Mexican territory that the Mexican government has stopped and returned to their country of origin, which means that U.S. authorities have not had to deal with that. So if we're looking at 175,000 Central American migrants a year, and last year's figures were quite similar, that is 175,000 Central American immigrants that the U.S. taxpayer does not have to pay to repatriate. Think about what happens if Mexico stops cooperating. If Mexico basically just opens the tap and lets those Central American migrants move through Mexican territory on their way to the United States, and that is not without cost for Mexico, we can talk about that if you like, but letting them get to the U.S. border and just basically saying, okay, U.S., you deal with that. And by the way, as Luis Videgaray said the other day, we are not going to deal with these people if you deport them to Mexico because we simply won't accept them. We have no obligation to do so. Mm-hmm. Then all of a sudden, you have the possibility of creating a real crisis on the U.S.-Mexico border.
The other, well, though it's unfortunate because a lot of the migrants are escaping persecution, as we understand, in their Central American countries. But yes, that is something that, you know, Mexico does have in terms of a powerful chip. There was also talk about how the Mexican government has been distributing money for deportation challenges here in the U.S. How big of, you know, a stick is that, do you think? Some wonder if it's actually a way to further clog the U.S. immigration court system.
Yeah, I think that is one possible intention here, but I think that much more likely is, in fact, the long tradition that Mexico has of helping its migrant population here in the United States through its consular network. One of the major goals of Mexican foreign policy has been to help its diaspora over the past 10 years. And presidential candidates and often congressional candidates talk about the importance of this. You know, when you've got 30-odd million people of Mexican origin living in the United States, then this is a very important part of your population. You know, if you look at how important that is in terms of its economic impact, it's estimated that the Mexican Americans living in the U.S. have a GDP which is comparable to that of Mexicans living in Mexico. This is a very potentially powerful group. What Mexico has been unsuccessful in doing in the past is actually coalescing that group into a coherent political force. They're working on it right now. Of course, the election last year was a huge wake-up call. Unfortunately, it came too late for them to do anything in the election itself. But that's something that will continue. The consular network itself is a powerful tool, and you know they have every right to use that to help their population, to help their citizens who are here in the United States. Now, it will actually have costs, of course, of slowing down the legal processes of deportation, but it's also a very, very important tool of international diplomacy.
We're talking with Duncan Wood, director of the Mexico Institute, the Wilson Center, and with Alfredo Corchado. He's Mexico correspondent at the Dallas Morning News and author of the new book, Midnight in Mexico, A Reporter's Journey Through a Country's Descent into Darkness. We're talking about the state of U.S.-Mexico relations, with Secretaries Tillerson and Kelly having been in Mexico this week, trying to strengthen what has been a fraying relationship. You can join the conversation with your questions about that relationship. You can call us at 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org. Post them on Facebook, on our website, kqed.org/forum, or you can tweet us. We're at @KQEDForum. Alfredo Corchado, you're hearing, you know, Duncan Wood talk about sort of the strength that Mexico has in negotiation against the United States. Do you feel optimistic about then, you know, the ability for the two nations to figure out a path forward, given their mutual concerns about each other's behaviors actually making them get along a little better?
You know, I'm a little optimistic in the sense that when I talk to Mexicans here in Mexico City, they understand that this is not an American versus Mexico thing. This is more of a Trump administration and some of his key advisors there that they're up against. But they feel like Americans in generally like them. They support them. I think they're heartened by the number of demonstrations, the number of protests that are going on. And you know, just to the point that Duncan was making, because it's very important, and you hear this a lot in Mexico, and you're hearing it more and more in the United States, that Mexico for many years has really been the wall. And they keep talking about, you know, let's build the wall. And Mexico feels like they have been the wall. And they have been, you know, they sort of keep an eye on the United States. They try to help keep the United States protected. I am hearing from some intelligence officials on the ground, U.S. intelligence officials, that they're worried about the cooperation at the ground level. That when they talk about cooperation, they say, you know, yes, we do have this long-standing cooperation. Things have gotten better over the last 10 years or so. But this rhetoric that's coming out from the White House isn't helping things. And so they do worry about the day when you know, will they get that? Will they continue to get that classified information, classified intelligence coming from the south? Will they be able to act on tips coming from the north? You know, this is going on in Guerrero or the southern state. Those are, I think, are real worries on the part of U.S. intelligence and even Mexican officials on the ground. But I think on just talking to people on the streets, you know. And I remember yesterday they were planning a massive protest again in front of the embassy. Went there and it was very, very small. Talked to people. Some people later asked, "Why weren't you protesting?" And it's almost like this is more of a Donald Trump thing, not so much against the Americans in the United States.
Alfredo Corchado, Mexico bureau chief for the Dallas Morning News. Sorry, Mexico correspondent for the Dallas Morning News, and Duncan Wood. We'll have more with them after the break. This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're looking at U.S.-Mexico relations. Tensions between the two countries are at their highest in decades over U.S. immigration policy, a proposed border wall, and uncertainty around NAFTA. We'd like you to join the conversation by giving us a call at 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org. Post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. You can tweet us. We're at @KQEDForum. And you can also find us on Facebook. We're being joined this hour by Duncan Wood, director of the Mexico Institute Wilson Center, and Alfredo Corchado, Mexico correspondent for the Dallas Morning News. Earlier, we were joined by Naha Catan. She's a correspondent for Bloomberg News in Mexico. And just before the break, Duncan Wood, we were hearing Alfredo Corchado talk about how a lot of the anger and frustration is directed at President Trump and, as you mentioned earlier, President Enrique Peña Nieto. The nationalism that President Trump's charged rhetoric has caused has sparked that deep nationalism. And at least at first, it didn't was not extending to the government itself. But I guess the question is, how big a liability are the contradictions between what President Trump is saying, you know, in just hours before the meeting with DHS Secretary John Kelly, where John Kelly had to assure people that there were no mass deportations and it was not a military operation. You had Trump saying that it was, in fact, a military operation. So how big a liability do you see him as? Or do you think, you know, the outcome of this meeting will have people saying, you know what, there is a path ahead?
So all throughout this this painful period in bilateral relations, we've seen that, when the dialogue or the channels of dialogue have been opened, and we seem to be making some progress, then there is a major step back or even two or three steps back. And that's come from either the president's Twitter account or from public statements that he's made. And, of course, yesterday we had another statement which was, you know, at a conference, a business conference, President Trump said, "We have a great relationship with Mexico. It's stupendous." Da, da, da. And he says, "And if we don't, we don't." Now, that kind of signaling causes the confusion that Alfredo talked about earlier on. It almost seems as though it is a deliberate tactic on the part of the U.S. administration to confuse in some way. But in fact, it's having the opposite effect. I think it's actually focusing minds. It's focusing the minds of the Mexican administration. We've talked about the nationalist impulse, but it's also focusing their minds on, well, how do we actually deal with this? This is not the relationship. This is not the counterpart that we had for 8 years or the 8 years before that. This is actually something new. And so we're going to focus on what we actually have control on. We're going to focus on not engaging at the presidential level as much as possible because that's damaging. And what we're going to do is we're going to actually focus on the channels of communication and the institutional mechanisms that happen at the second and third level below that. Mexicans and the Mexican administration in particular has taken a great deal of heart from the positive approach taken by Kelly and Tillerson, both of whom in their confirmation hearings expressed deep respect for Mexico as a country and for Mexico as a partner for the United States along immigration, security, and economic fronts. We've heard similar things from General Mattis over at the Department of Defense. These are very important signs for the Mexicans to seize on and to take heart from. And that's why I think we're seeing them actually focus on, you know, keeping going with the institutional mechanisms. The Mexicans know very well that at the Department of State, there are many, many people who have dedicated their careers over the last decade to building a more positive relationship with Mexico. The same thing at the Department of Defense. You hear the U.S. military talk about the cooperation that they have developed with their Mexican counterparts, and you hear them speaking in glowing terms about the ways in which the Mexican military now interacts with them in ways which were unthinkable before. All of this means that Mexico, if they can focus on the administration writ large rather than just the White House, they believe that they actually have a chance of saving things. However, every time that there is a detrimental comment or every time that there is an aggressive signal from the White House, then it becomes much more difficult for the Mexicans to keep that balanced perspective and to stay optimistic.
Well, let's hear from our listeners. Let's hear from Ken in San Francisco. Hi, Ken.
Hi, good morning. I can't believe I'm hearing hope in Mexico's police force. We know over the years with worldwide coverage, thousands of women and girls, 26,000 upwards of that in the last decade, have disappeared, been kidnapped or murdered in Mexico. There's been international attention for this, and they all point the fingers at the police and security forces and corrupt Mexico political system that refuses to do anything about this. These are people's lives. These are their own citizens. I mean, Mexico's government seems to have its priority economic plan seems to be to drive its poorest across the border to make money and send it back into the country, what they do to help their families. So when I hear talk about Trump versus Nieto, we should be reminded that that idiot in the White House had a third of all Hispanic voters voted for him. So my question is, why is there so little coverage of Mexico's endemic corruption in their government? It seems to be not being addressed at all.
Ken, thanks for the question. I mean, that certainly is one of those forces out there that cannot be ignored, Operator Corchado, in terms of the political situation, the corruption, the police issues that Mexico has.
No, you can't ignore that. You can't ignore the endemic corruption that's still in many places widespread in Mexico. A lot of reporters, a lot of colleagues, correspondents that have focused, I think, over the last 10 years or more on looking at the corruption, looking at issues like the women of Juarez, looking at the violence in Mexico. I mean, my whole book, Midnight in Mexico, is dedicated to that theme. So it's not something that we brushed aside. Yeah, it continues to be a big issue. I think the hope is really in the sense that there is more cooperation between both sides. And I also see that there's more hope in the building of civil society in Mexico. I mean, Ciudad Juarez, the city that Ken is talking about, where so many women have disappeared, you see a much more active, much more robust civil society. Is Juarez perfect? By, no way. I mean, it's not there yet. But it is a much stronger, much better city than it was, say, even 3 years ago. I think when you cover Mexico as a correspondent, you have to sort of also nuance, the bad and the good. Mexico itself, the country itself, is not falling apart. I mean, it's not coming at the seams. There are regions in Mexico that are, you can say they're much more well-off and much more middle class. One of the things that was interesting yesterday in the Kelly Tillerson was the acknowledgement that Mexico is now much more of a transient point for migrants going north, as Duncan was talking about, much more Central Americans coming through Mexico than Mexicans heading north for opportunity.
Yes,
there are some Mexicans, but the net flow is really zero.
Right, it's been at zero for the past few years. Net migration from Mexico,
right.
Yes. I guess, though...
Can I just come in here?
I
feel quite strongly about
Duncan
this.
Duncan Wood,
and,
yes.
You know, I think that if you were to claim, that there is not coverage of corruption and violence in Mexico, you would have to have not read a newspaper, visited a website, or turned on a television for the past decade. That's all that dominates the news about Mexico. The fact is that 90% of the coverage of Mexico in this country and around the world is actually negative. And not without due cause, all of us recognize the enormous challenges that exist in Mexico. And the fact is that the Mexican Federal Police is an organization which faces very real problems, but has made progress over the last decade. Police at other levels, at the levels of the states and municipalities, face an even much, much bigger challenge than that. Nobody would question the fact that there is a serious human rights record in Mexico. But the fact is that this is a country that is trying to improve its situation, has been working very closely with the United States government to do so through the Merida Initiative, and has paid an enormous cost for that, not just in financial terms. You know, we talk a lot about the aid that the United States gives to Mexico to fight organized crime, a total of $1.6 billion over 10 years. Every single year, the Mexican government spends $10 to $12 billion of its own money fighting organized crime. That's the financial side of things. What about the cost in terms of human life? We've seen over the past 10 years 200,000 homicides in Mexico, at least half of which are directly linked to the fight against organized crime. There has been enormous disruption of life in Mexico. And as many Mexicans would argue, this is because Mexicans are trying to fight the organizations which move drugs northwards to a market in the United States, which seems to be a never-ending market, a never-ending source of consumption. And as I was talking to a class over at Georgetown this morning, the Mexican perspective is, why are we paying the price for the fact that Americans want to inject stuff into their veins, put stuff up their nose, Why don't we just let those products move through our territory uninterrupted? If the Americans want to do that, that's their business. Why are we fighting against it? Now, of course, it's much more complicated than that. Of course, there is a cost for governance and governability in Mexico. There is infiltration of local government, state government by organized crime. But the fact is that Mexicans increasingly feel as though they have paid a very, very heavy price for all of this. And in terms of the economic plan, let's focus on that question of net zero or net negative migration. As Alfredo said, there are still Mexicans moving in an undocumented fashion across the border. But the fact is there are more Mexicans leaving the United States now than are going there. And the reason for that? One, demographics. There are much less young men than there were in the past, which means that they're not out there looking for work in the same numbers. And two, Mexico's done an impressive job of creating economic opportunities. Migrants actually don't want to leave home. Migrants would much rather stay where they were born and pursue economic opportunities in those regions. We see it around the world. I've been a migrant three times in my life, in Canada, Mexico, and now the United States. And the fact is, you move because you are looking for a better life. Mexicans have told researchers over and over again, if they can actually have a dignified life in their hometown or in the home country, they don't want to leave. And most of them, when they do leave, want to go back eventually. The thing is that over the last 20 years, we've interrupted circular migration in a way that has been counterproductive. It's forced Mexicans and people from other countries to come to the United States and stay because they're so afraid of leaving that they wouldn't be able to get back again.
So are you saying that a border wall could actually increase or at least stop more migration back to Mexico?
I think that what we're likely to see is that the people who come here are much less likely ever to go home again.
And, you know, I bring up the political and economic situation in Mexico in terms of it can't be ignored, because the question, I think, is whether or not Mexico could handle, given some of the vulnerabilities that it has, right, with corruption and other things, can it handle a period of economic stagnation should it occur over disputes over renegotiating or even tearing up NAFTA, as President Trump has threatened to do? Duncan.
So there will be a very heavy cost to pay for that. It seems to me as though Mexicans themselves, being a very proud people, would be willing to pay that, at least in the abstract. Hmm. But what are the consequences of that? Well, Mexico has been growing economically, but not at a very high rate. Its economic profile is much more like that of a developed country than a developing country. Sort of growth rates around the 2% mark, has low inflation, has low unemployment, but a very high underemployment in the economy. If we were to enter a period of prolonged recession, then I think that the consequences would be quite severe for the Mexican public and for the Mexican polity. What we're looking at is a presidential election in 2018 where the left-wing candidate, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, who represents the Morena Party, is already very likely to win. If he wins in 2018, he will come to power at a time where there is an already antagonistic relationship with the United States. If Mexicans are suffering economically because of that antagonistic relationship, then they're likely to push Andrés Manuel López Obrador to pursue much more nationalistic strategies, and also to look for friends internationally, which are not necessarily the friends that the United States would want its neighbor to have. So, for example, China is incredibly interested in getting a foothold in Mexico. In fact, in December of last year, the Chinese National Offshore Oil Company won two blocks in Mexico's deep water bidding round in the Gulf of Mexico. China is very interested in pursuing other infrastructure projects in Mexico. You can see a future where Mexico reaches out to other oil producers to work more closely with OPEC. Is that something that the United States would really like Mexico to do? And there are all kinds of other scenarios out there. The fact is that whatever happens to Mexico now matters to the United States. If Mexico does well, the United States will do well. If Mexico does badly, the United States does badly. And a shrinking of the economic opportunities in Mexico, a shrinking of the market for those $240 billion in U.S. exports to Mexico every year is obviously going to hurt a lot of people here in the U.S.
Well, Rick writes, this promised wall between our country and Mexico could create a better Mexico. Why send your dreamers and pioneers to America when your own country desperately needs this talent? Time for Mexico to fix this disaster. Joe writes, if we have to have a wall, why not build it with high-speed rail on top, connect Houston to San Diego, and connect that to California's proposal proposed high-speed rail. We had a segment earlier that was talking about a commuter rail system here in California. Let me go to Claudia in Oakland. Hi, Claudia. What's on your mind?
Hi, good morning. I just wanted to give a quick counterpoint to the earlier caller. We must consider the history of the economic policies between these countries. I'm actually from Mexico. I am originally from a farming town. My mom was a farmer, and we were brought here. I'm actually one of the DACA recipients. My sisters and I, the four of us, have it. And we've been here now 23 years since we were children. I'm now in my 30s and consider myself American. But the earlier caller was talking about corruption in Mexico. And, you know, if it wasn't for policies like NAFTA, we were a very thriving town. We were farmers, but my mother couldn't find any. We could not compete with, like, the cheap produce, and especially corn, that was coming in from the States and totally destroyed the economic, any economy that we had as far as farmers. So I just think that we really have to consider the history of economic policy that has driven a lot of these people who are already in poverty to do this. And it secured a constant flow of cheap labor to the United States. I mean, my mom has been cleaning houses her whole life. Luckily, we did a little better. But, you know, for all the opportunities that this country has given my sisters and I, how many has it robbed us? You know? So anyway, that's my
point. So what would you like to see happen with NAFTA?
With DACA or NAFTA?
NAFTA.
NAFTA. Well, I feel like these countries need to be, NAFTA specifically, you know, I don't know what we could do. I would say teach people how to grow things organic, get away from that sort of thing. Help economies and countries not to have to rely on this sort of industries that don't necessarily ever get them out of poverty. You know, a lot of that needs to happen in order for people to stay, because I would have loved to stay. My grandmother's dying and I can't go see her. I mean, it's really difficult for people, and it cripples an entire generation or more to do better and to make both countries better, because I feel that's what most of us want, including immigrants, especially immigrants. I think a lot of Americans don't really grasp that because they haven't lived it.
Well, Claudia, I want to thank you for sharing your story. Let's hear from Gwen in San Francisco. Hi, Gwen.
Hi. I used to have a newspaper called Morena Newspaper for Women of Color, and I would go back and forth to Mexico. And one time I took the bus, and I noticed I was sitting in the back with these Honduran, Belize, and Guatemalan guys. They had worked in for San Fernando, and they were on their way home. And the Federales get on the bus, or whoever they were, checked everybody's paper, yanked these guys off the bus, beat the crap out of them in front of everybody, and hauled them off. So they do, you know, they are monitoring their borders. I don't approve of abuse like that, but they do monitor their borders. And also the same conversation we're having about Mexico and Costa Rica, they're saying the same thing about the Nicaraguans coming across the border, taking jobs, you know, committing crimes. And we're in a global economy, and the have-nots are going to where the haves are to do work.
Well, Gwen, thanks for your point as well. And let me try to get some more. We're getting a few calls in here. Bonnie in Richmond. Hi, Bonnie.
Hello. I would like to say we've traveled in remote areas of Mexico, from the Copper Canyon to Chiapas, from Mazatlan to Veracruz of Villa Hermosa, where there's a fantastic Olmec museum. We have had many people befriend us. They are wonderful people. We have stayed for 6 weeks or so in cities and towns, and we're too old to do that now and jump on and off the buses. But we love it, and there are many, many retirees living in Mexico, expatriates from the U.S., who are getting great dental care and medical care, and it's very cheap. So
yes,
the U.S. should not complain about Mexico, because it's a beautiful, beautiful country. You haven't seen it. Go there.
Yes, well, Bonnie, I think our last caller, Alfredo Corchado, is, you know, underscoring just how much our two nations are intertwined. Another listener writes, Donald Trump's actions since he took office could be best described as that of a wild bull in a china shop. He alienated and insulted many world leaders. His racist policies against Mexican migrants will cause lots of economic damage to the country, and his hate mongering toward Muslims is totally counterproductive. He should instead unite with these nations. Alfredo Corchado, I read actually that there was some talk too, if, you know, the United States starts trying to, you know, deport significant numbers of people back into Mexico, Mexico could resist by, you know, demanding that the U.S. prove that they're Mexican, because of course they were outlining their role as a sovereign nation, not having to, you know, unilaterally abide by whatever the U.S. says. Are you hearing that?
Right. I mean, I am hearing that. And Duncan may have better numbers, but one stat that I hear is that at least one third of the undocumented population in the United States does not have documents. I mean, so it's going to be really hard for them to prove that they are, you know, from Mexico. And but also, I think the Mexican government can make it much more difficult in not cooperating, in not helping them do that fact checking or checking out the claims, et cetera. One point I want to make in the last column, I mean, oftentimes Americans also forget that there are something like 1.5, sometimes some people say 2 million Americans who live in Mexico. I think Americans make up the largest foreign population in this country. I was just interviewing some of them the other day, and there's a sense of, oh my God, you know, I'm horrified at how they're treating Mexico. I hope we don't get the same treatment. I don't see that happening, but it's also interesting I think the American population to understand that that Mexico also has a huge population, many of them also living here without the proper documents, by the way.
There was a report that President Trump had reiterated the wall this morning, but am I right in an understanding that that didn't really come up between the conversations with Secretaries Tillerson, Kelly, and Mexican officials? Alfredo Corchado.
At least what I'm told is that it did come up during the private conversations, and again, we are reiterating that we're not paying for the wall, et cetera. But I mean, the main conversation was really evolved around the latest guidelines set by the Trump administration. Obviously, NAFTA came up. Obviously, energy. We have to remember that Mr. Tillerson is the ex-head of Exxon. So energy is something he's very familiar with. There's a lot of interest in a big delegation from Texas coming to Mexico next week. As Duncan was saying, you know, part of the strategy is to take the message to individual states. And so people are looking at this delegation coming from Texas with the same, probably, you know, a little more of a sense of this is our strategy. This is how we're going to maybe turn minds around, turn the attitude around by going after a big Republican state like Texas and trying to, through them, hopefully sway the Trump administration some on issues of NAFTA and other things.
Duncan Wood, what do you make of President Trump's request to have a full accounting of what the U.S. gives to Mexico? The deadline was today, and having it in an executive order that was linked to the wall. Do you think, as many presume, that this is, you know, a way to get leverage against our southern neighbor?
It's funny. I, first of all, of course, I don't have any problem with accounting. I think it's absolutely fundamental that the American taxpayer should know how its dollars are being spent.
But this was linked to immigration orders.
No, absolutely. And, but the second thing is this, is that when you actually look at how much aid has been spent on Mexico over the years, I gave you that figure earlier of $1.6 billion over 10 years. That doesn't work out to be very much money each year. But of course, there are lots of other programs. But we're looking at, you know, a total of, you know, maybe $1 billion or something like that. It's going to take you an awfully long time to compensate for a $21 billion wall by cutting aid to another country. Is that going to gain you leverage? No, for the simple reason that Mexico can get on quite well without the money. What will be lost is the relationship, the person-to-person and the institution-to-institution links that have been built up through that aid. It was never about the money. It was always about actually getting to a situation where the two countries could work together. Now, what's the out for all of this? Because, I mean, this is a question that obsesses me in my day-to-day work, which is we all know that President Trump needs to have a win on the question of the wall.
Yes.
And has staked his reputation on the idea that Mexico will pay for it.
Yes, he's talked about a 20% tax on Mexican imports. He's even talked about seizing remittances from Mexicans in some way.
Right. So we all know that Mexico is not going to pay for the wall, so he has to find some other way of doing it. Let's say that it's focused on the aid to Mexico. It takes you 20 years to pay for the wall. Okay, fine. What if we were to do something else a little bit more creative, though? What if we were to look at all the money that Mexico has spent over the last 10 years and projecting forward on actually keeping migrants out of the United States in terms of, you know, creating opportunities for Mexican migrants so they don't have to go north and strengthening their southern border. As obnoxious as that may sound, Mexico is actually paying a heavy price for that. What if we were to actually say, look, Mexico has done an incredible job, has been an incredible partner to the United States and has spent a lot of money on doing that. And we will consider that in payment for what we think that Mexico should be paying for the wall. Mexico will never accept that, of course. They're not going to say this is the way that we're going to pay for the wall because we're not paying for the wall. But it allows the U.S. administration to walk away and to say, you know, Mexico's done its part.
Well, Duncan Wood, I want to thank you for joining us this morning. Duncan Wood, director of the Mexico Institute at the Wilson Center. And also thanks to Alfredo Corchado, Mexico correspondent for the Dallas Morning News and author of the new book, Midnight in Mexico, A Reporter's Journey Through a Country's Descent into Darkness. And thanks to our listeners for your questions and comments. Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Judy Campbell, Tina Lauerberg, and Susan Britton and Jeremy Siegel. Our engineer this morning is Jim Bennett. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from Amanda Font. Our interns are Stephanie Roberts and Devin Holt. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and Holly Kernan is our executive producer. I'm Mina Kim. Thank you for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.